Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. You know the leaves on the trees are falling to the sound of the breezes that blow. You know I'm trying to please to the calling of your heartstrings that play soft and low. You know the night.
What's up, everybody? This is Xander Horwitz. I'm not filling in today. I'm being the host, but we have a special guest, a man that you guys all know and love. He's on the show every day because he runs it. I'm interviewing Todd Bubba Horwitz today. He's my dad. How you doing, Bub?
What's up there, Xander? How you doing, brother?
Good, good. It's a little different running the Bubba show. You know, I've been on the show a few times. It's been a lot of fun. We talked about, you know, a lot of different topics, some politics, a little bit about my life, just a back and forth. I'm used to running the Sporting Edge, but yeah, a little different, a lot more viewers on this show. So I thought, you know, while you're giving your take on the markets all the time and what you think of the political scene and just the overall economy, maybe we could get a little more background on your life and how you got started into trading, you know, what took you away from it, what brought you back. So I guess my first question to you would be, what got you into the markets? I know you were a young man. I think, you know, I recall 21 or 22 when you started trading on the floor. Could be wrong, but, you know, what got you into it? What were you doing before? And, you know, how did that start out for you?
That's actually a couple of good questions. And actually, I was a senior in high school, and I decided I wasn't going to go to college. And I actually took a job as a salesman at Pitney Bowes. Back in 1974 or 75, and I was actually still in high school at the time, and I used to go to school in the morning, then go to the job, and then go back to school, and then go back to the job, and I did pretty well, and was one of the top salesmen in the region, and became actually one of the top teachers and trainers in the company as well, and did quite well back in those days, and made a lot of money, selling postage meters, believe it or not, and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed being out, and I enjoyed, teaching people how to use it and how to have the customers take best advantage of the equipment and the salesmen to learn how to deal with the customers the best way. And, after about 4 years there, I decided that, this could be my career and I'm going to make a career out of it. And, you know, they had, you know, it was a huge company back then, and they'd been under the subject of monopolies and all the other things. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to make this my career. And, I went to the management and I said, hey, why don't you promote me? Now, they had no idea that I was only 17 when I took the job. Okay. They, in those days, you know, we didn't have all these laws and political correctness. And they said, well, you're too young. And I said, what do you mean I'm too young? I said, I'm not too young to be the number one salesman in the country. I'm not too young to teach all the employees here. What am I too young for? And, you know, of course, in those days, you could say whatever you want. And they basically said it. And I said, well, basically, blank you. I threw my gear at him and I said, I quit. And I walked out. And of course, not knowing where I was going to go, but of course I didn't have expenses. I didn't have kids. I didn't have college. I didn't have anything to pay for. So I could survive without doing it. And I ended up deciding that I knew some guys that were on the trading floor. And I decided, you know what, let's go down and try to trade. And, the interesting thing about trading is you have to first find a clearing firm that is willing to take your risk. Okay. You have to worry about the risk that you're going to take. And so, because somebody in trading, there's all in exchange organized trading, there has to be a clearing member that is going to back you. So if you blow your brains out and lose $1 billion, somebody is there to back that up. And so it took some time to, you know, meet with some people and get a firm to agree that they would back and take my trades. And so once that was done, then you have to take a test. And then I had to buy a seat or rent a seat. Well, in those days, they had what they call the small seat. So I bought a small seat and I came up with $25,000 and started my career as a trader. And of course, it's now, 36 years later and I'm still trading. I'm just not trading on the floor anymore. But it was quite the experience, and obviously a lot to learn, and which is why I love to, you know, pass on the knowledge to others, because there's a lot to it other than just trading.
Right, and I mean that the career that you just described to all of us, I mean, it doesn't really exist as much anymore. I mean, I know you've taken me down to the Board of Trade a few times, and it's not like what you see in the movies. You know, trading places, or, you know, there you got 1,000, 2,000 people just screaming and yelling at each other. It really doesn't exist like it used to. You know, a lot of it is electronic now. I think we saw that probably 14 or 15 years ago, I think, was when it started to get pretty big. And now, you know, I think everything is run by a computer these days. But Bob, you know, how long did you end up trading for on the floor before you decided to take the next step in your life?
Well, I was on the floor at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange from 80 to 93 or so. And then I went from there to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and switched from trading options to trading futures. And I traded in the S&P futures there. And then in 2000, I went to the Board of Trade because they opened up a brand new pit, which was the Dow pit, the Dow Mini Futures. And, you know, I traded at all the exchanges anyways, you know, through my account, because obviously, you know, if I wanted to trade grains, they had to be at the Board of Trade. If I wanted to trade, you know, cattle or pork bellies or things like that, I had to trade those at the CME. And if I wanted to trade options, you had to use the CBOE. So we always traded at all three accounts. And in fact, we had trades that we actually did. Which for floor traders, which was a great trade, which were called reversals and conversions, in which you use the OEX options against the S&P futures. So you're using different exchanges and different products, but they created a model in which you could lock in profit right away when you made the trade.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that sounds super interesting. I remember you started teaching me about the market. I think I was about 14 or 15 years old. And, you know, I remember, like, the first time we ever started talking about it, you know, I asked you basically a simple question of, you know, what is the stock market? That's kind of a tough question, I think, to explain to somebody who really had, you know, no knowledge whatsoever of basically what a market was, what the stock market was, you know, what companies did, how they made money and all that. And, you know, here we are, you know, about 8 years later. It taught me so much, you know, about options, about stocks, about all this. And I actually took it upon myself to start teaching a few of my buddies at school, the high school program that we came up with together. And it's been very rewarding, you know, teaching people about something that can really help them later in life, you know, a skill that is basically invaluable. I mean, no matter how you look at it. You know, managing your money and knowing, you know, what goes on in the world of financials is very important, I think, to any walk of life. You know, whether you're interested in it or not, I mean, it's going to be a part of your life somehow. I mean, you know, even if you're not involved at all, and people retire, they want to make money in retirement and have money for retirement. So, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways to look at it. And I feel very fortunate that I got to learn from somebody who has been so involved in the markets for his entire life. But Bub, so you said, you know, you got up to 2000, you're trading in a lot of different stuff. But I know you walked away a little bit from the markets a little bit, and I know you're back now, but, you know, can you take me through that part of your life? I know me and my sister were pretty young back then, but, you know, you stepped away for a little, and I know you came back. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I didn't really step away. I was always trading. I just had to find other things because the trading model had changed. You know, the trading on the floor with an edge was no longer available to guys like me. And so the difference is you had to be prepared to trade off of the floor. And instead of being a person who traded order flow and paper flow, you traded strictly a position. So you pick the side of the market or a side of a stock and you went with that. So instead of, you know, what I learned and how I started trading was to trade back and forth based on what they call order flow or paper flow.
All right, hold that thought, Bub. We're going to get back to the story after the break. If you miss the show, you know where to find Bubba and myself for today, libertytalk.fm, and we'll see you after the break. What's up, everybody? Back here. different host running the show today. This is Bubba's son, Xander, and I'm actually interviewing Bubba today. So, Bubba, go on what you were saying before the break.
Well, so anyway, so in the dynamics of the floor trader, you know, when you're a floor trader, you're not trading direction. You're not trading the markets. You're trading what they call order flow. And, you know, orders come in. And our job was what we would call trade the edge. Now, it doesn't mean we didn't take shots at the market and pick directions. But basically, your job was, you know, first of all, then the markets were trading in fractions instead of decimals.
Right.
And, you know, if somebody came in and was a buyer, you would offer them at the offer price. And if somebody was a seller, you would buy in the bid price. And my job was to sell at the offer and buy in the bid and lock in either a 16th or an eighth or a quarter or more on any one given trade. And when you go off the floor, that edge is no longer there. And of course, that edge has been slowly declining for everybody because once they went to the decimal system, you, instead of getting 6 cents within a market, they can now get within a penny. Wide. Well, it doesn't sound like much, but you know, 100 contracts, 100 pennies is 100 bucks. You know, actually, it's 1,000 pennies, 100 contracts, and on a 16th, that's 625. So, the edge became almost impossible to trade. So you had to become what we would call now an electronic trader, and no longer were you trading order or paper flow. You were trading direction, and now you had to go from a guy who could, you know, read the markets like blindfolded, because that's what you were doing. Now you have to, you know, you read charts, you try to, you know, you try to assume the market footprint, you're looking for direction, and you're trying to get with the direction if you're a trend trader, or you're trying to be against if you're a counter trend. And there's difference. I've done both, and I do both. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to move forward and move on. And now again, the risk model has changed as well, because again, when I was trading with the edge, don't get me wrong, I had plenty of bad days, but that was more because I was, you know, maybe taking a shot here and there. And again, I don't ever deny that. But you do have, in today's market, you have to actually lay it out there and say, okay, and how big do you want to trade? You know, and when I was on the floor, I might trade, I mean, I think the biggest that I ever traded was maybe 50,000 contracts in one day. You know, now, you know, you can't trade like that because, A, the commissions would eat you up. So you lose a lot of the edge. So now you have to be more of a technician and more of a market maker. So at the same time, when I was trading, I also endeavored into some other businesses and invested in some other businesses and helped run some of them. And, was busy running around, checking my people's businesses and seeing what was going on. And of course, none of them were anywhere near as successful as trading, and ended up getting rid of all those because they were more of a headache than they were worth. But, at the end of the day, you know, I've never really left the trading part of it. I just, you know, I did other things at the same time. And now I'm just, you know, basically trading full time and, you know, teaching different models for depending on who you want to be, you know, because everybody thinks that being a day trader is an easy job. And of course, a day trader is probably the hardest job that there is, because you really can't leave the machine. You are glued to that machine from, you know, in Chicago, 8:30. Minimum till 3:15, but really you could be there from, you know, 5 a.m. till 5 p.m. If you wanted to do it right, and you can't leave. I mean, you're chained to that machine because the move you're waiting for could happen at any time, and if you're not there to enjoy it, then you miss it. And of course, that's the problem. We cannot afford to miss those moves because you're waiting for a specific action. So what I've done is I've developed ways to, you know, be part-time day traders, because many people that, you know, come with me, they might have full-time jobs. They might have, you know, other things they want to do. They might be retired but don't want to be stuck with the machine. So what I teach now, besides the option model and how to swing trade or longer-term trade, is how to be a part-time day trader. In fact, later today I'm doing a webinar on that. But you can sit down. You got an hour. You can sit down for an hour, and if the pattern appears that we're looking for, and we're looking for one specific pattern, if it shows, we can make the trade. And it's nice to trade like that because you've got very little risk, and you've still got the unlimited upside potential if it appears. So again, the game has changed, but fortunately, the knowledge that I have gained and continue to gain is great to help those who need some help with what we would call financial literacy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, talking about those strategies that, you know, allow you to be a little more free but still be a part-time trader, I think one of the best things you taught me was credit spreads. An interesting thing about those is, you know, you basically can look at a chart a week before and you know, technically, you know, look at a chart, look at levels of what you see, and you can put something on and, you know, wait till the next week. And you basically, you don't have to look at it week to week. And that was something that I really loved that you started me off on a few years ago. And, you know, I have to say I've been a little lazy as of late, but, you know, that strategy, I think, is something that's great for people, you know, who, you know, like myself. I go to school. I'm doing a lot of stuff. I don't really have time. I do like trading, but I, like you said, I don't have time to sit in front of a machine for 12 hours a day. But, yeah, credit spreads, I think, was one of the more valuable lessons I've learned so far about the markets with you.
Well, no, I mean, it actually is a great beginning strategy for many, and it's a great way to try to generate extra revenue. And again, you know, people have to decide why they're in the markets, and you know, the answers are typically, I want to make more money, I want to make additional money, or I want to make extra money, or I want to protect my retirement. And you know, by using credit and selling options, I mean, we know that, you know, the insurance companies, they sell premiums, you know, they charge premiums for their insurance products. Well, options carry premiums as well, and our job is to be able to identify you know, where the edge is and where we think we can do the best. And I think that is something that many people miss out on. And I think it's a simple process. And I think what happens, Xander, is too many people think that you can sell those, what they call them, the high probability model stuff, that are way out of the money. Mm-hmm. And you make nothing, basically. And by the time you pay commissions, you really make nothing. But yet, you know, you make money, you know, on those, you know, 9 out of 10 trades, but then the 10th trade comes and whacks you and takes away all your money, and you've gone nowhere, you've lost money. And that's where people, I think, get fooled by the market, because if you remember one thing, okay, the market is brilliant. It never makes a mistake, it never gets sick, it never gets tired, and it's always going to be right. So you can't afford to give up and sell something too cheap, because eventually you're going to get it stuck to you. And that is typically the reason that most people end up not trading anymore, is because they put themselves in positions that eventually they just get wiped out and it becomes just too distressing.
Right. And Bubba, you know, I got a question for you. I mean, this is something I've talked about with a few people, and I wanted to get your opinion. You know, in today's day and age, you know, there's a lot of machine trading going on out there. You know, certain algorithms trigger, you know, certain points in the market. And I wanted to get your opinion. How much do you think, you know, machine trading, you know, like massive amounts at one time, is responsible for market moves like in today's times?
Well, you know, again, I'm on the other side of that coin. Mm-hmm. For the average retail trader, the machines, the electronic trading has never been more of an advantage to a typical retail trader. Because right now, if you think about it, now when I first started trading, not on the floor, but as just as a retailer, you had to pay like $100 for commission. Okay.
Right.
Now your commission is, let's say, $7.95. Okay, for that same trade. So it's $93 difference. When I first started trading, options were trading in fractions. And if you bought a stock that was, let's say, a $50 stock, the bid offer spread might have been $50 wide, 50 cents. So it's $50. Mm-hmm. All right. So to get in the trade, you were giving up $150 just to get in. Okay. And if you were going to get out, you'd be giving up $150 to get out. So you had to make $300 just to get in and out. Now you can make $20 to get in and out and be in the same position. So from my perspective, you know, the Michael Lewis book on this they call them the Flash Boys, is all garbage, because the retail trader never had it better than they do today. And they can talk about the money that they're stealing out of the market, you know, through the bid offer spread and the time delay, but they're stealing a dollar versus in the day they were getting $50 for the same thing. So again, I think that it benefits everybody. And it's still, even electronic trading, it still leaves a footprint, which is really what we're looking for, is the footprint that the market leaves, because all we're trying to track is the money flow so that we can be a part of it. And that's where I think a lot of people misunderstand what electronic trading is all about.
Right. And I think a great part, you know, even for myself, looking back, you can learn basically from any chart that you look at. Because, I mean, one of your great points, you've always told me, if you take away price and time, all charts are the same. So, I mean, the fact that, you know, all these charts have been logged, I think, you know, basically since the beginning of electronic trading, and you can look back and learn from patterns that have repeated themselves over and over again. It makes for a great advantage. That's all the time we have here for the Bubba Show. If you miss one, you know where to find us, libertytalk.fm, and we will see you after the break.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got the Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Unfamiliar voice today. This is Bubba's son, Xander. I've been on the show a few times, and today I'm continuing my interview of my dad, Todd Bubba Horwitz. And Bub, you know, we were just talking about the advantages of being a retail trader in today's times. I wanted to get a little bit more into your career as you started to teach people how to trade. You know, if I remember correctly, I was about 12 or 13 years old. I still remember being in the car with you. We were outside a wildfire. You'd actually ordered a book on trading, and I remember you started talking to someone that led into the conversation of, do you want to teach people how to trade? And I remember from that day on, you basically went on this, you know, this course of, you know, having all these different ways of teaching people your knowledge. So I wanted you to take me a little bit through the beginning of you really starting to teach people how to trade, and you know, where it's led up to today.
Yeah, it was interesting. I did get, you know, I never really thought about it. I mean, I was very comfortable playing golf on Thursdays and, you know, running around and just trading and, you know, doing my thing and enjoying the my ways of being free all the time. But I always had a passion, as you know, to coach, as I coached kids and even coach teams that you didn't play on. So, I always liked sharing my knowledge with others because, again, you know, when you're lucky enough in life to get some good things happen to you, you want to be able to give back to people. And so my way of giving back was to actually start to teach because, you know, I'm a big anti. I get very irritated when what I call the fear mongers are out there, you know, trying to scare people into trying something. To me, that's you do a big disservice to people, and it really upsets me as a person and as a person in the industry, because they give the industry a bad name. And so, you know, I thought that I could actually, you know, show people and share ideas with people. And I actually did train people actually one-on-one for a while. And then I decided to do it in a group setting because I could reach more people. And of course, that begat the book that I wrote about trading. And that also brought on the high school program, because now I just think that if we can catch, you know, kids young enough to teach them, because I think one of the big things, mistakes we make in life is the talk that parents have, and it shouldn't be about the birds and bees. It should be about money. Okay, because you know they learn enough about the birds and bees in school. I think the real talk is about finances, and what happens is many times, and you'll find this today, that, you know, many people don't know what to do with their finances, and they're always depending on somebody else to make those key decisions. And the problem is, most of the people that make the decisions don't have a clue either. They're really in it for the money, and as I like to say, life comes down to a couple of things, and one of them is money. And I think the important thing, and the thing that we're missing, is that, you know, we don't teach our youth enough about how to protect their money. It doesn't mean you have to be active traders. It just means at least you should have the knowledge to know what your advisor is doing with your money, or if your money's in a pension or a 401k, what they're doing with it. So you have the knowledge. So if you decide that you'd like to do something like protect it, you can, because, as you know, I built this hedging model. that, you know, actually protects people, and actually in time they will make more money, because the key to the stock market is what they call the compounding effect. And, you know, if you can keep your money in without trying to churn it, not trying to pick bottoms and tops, your money will grow, because the stock market itself in history has gone up approximately 9% year over year. It just doesn't go up every year. And we have to fight a lot of battles. But if you're buying good, solid paying, good dividend stocks that are good fundamental companies, and you can buy them on technical reasons, you will put yourself in a much better place in life financially. And you'll never have to make that key decision, if you learn how to hedge, of, well, do I sell here? Do I move to something else? Do I buy protection? What do I do? It just makes it easy. You don't have to make that decision. We've taken that decision away from you and teach you how to just continue to stay in the market actively, compounding your portfolio, actually creating what we call the endowment model.
Yeah, you know, getting back, you know, to your point about, you know, some people invest, some people trade. I think that was one of the things I stressed. You know, I got about five or six guys that were really interested. I told them about the program that we wrote together, and they were really interested in it. And I remember one of the first things I said, you know what, I mean, I'll teach you guys about markets. I'll teach you guys about all these things that have to do with markets. But, I mean, you don't have – not everybody has to be a trader. Like you said, not everybody has to be a day trader. You don't even have to really look at the markets. But the fact that you should know what's going on with your money later in life, I think, is really important. You know, I've been lucky enough to, you know, been around sort of the business with you, I'd say, for the past 10 years. But, I mean, you know, all kids aren't so fortunate. And I think, you know, this program, if it were instituted in basically every high school, I think should be almost every high school in America, I think it'd be doing, you know, the youth in this country a big service. Because, I mean, you know, you do a lot of important stuff in high school, but I think, you know, people see as they grow up and they go to school, a lot of it is learning, you know, basically how to be an adult and get through things. I mean, I know I've learned a lot in high school, I've learned a lot in college, but for me, almost the most important thing I think I've learned in college is basically, you know, it's kind of a step between, you know, being a kid and being an adult. You know, I don't really have to pay for my entire life yet. You know, I don't have a job yet, but I do live on my own. You know, if I want to eat, I got to get my ass out of bed and cook myself breakfast. So, you know, there's different ways and different things to learn. But, I mean, financial literacy, I think, is definitely one of the most important things. Because, you know, no matter what you say, you know, money is not the be-all, end-all of happiness. But, you know, if you don't have any money, I don't think you can't be very happy, because it's kind of a hard life to live, and it's definitely a struggle. But, yeah, you know, I think that was the most important point I stressed to, you know, a couple of my friends who I was teaching to. I was like, you guys can take this wherever you want. If you want to end up start trading on your own, that's great. If you want to just invest and be involved in the stock market, that's great. If you just want to know what's going on in general and don't really care what's going on, that's fine too. But I just felt it was important, and they've come to realize, you know, I'm about the seventh or eighth week of teaching these guys, you know, they've come to realize, you know, how important learning all this stuff is. And I got a little lazy. I took a couple weeks off. We had finals coming up, and I had some kids who I never thought, you know, would have asked me. I said, you know, when are you doing class again? I mean, and I said, you know, and I get to it, I'll be back next semester. So it's been interesting. It's been very rewarding. Like you said, teaching people is a whole different ball game. And for me, you know, I remember when I first talked to you about this, you know, I was thinking about, you know, starting a class up with some fraternity buddies. And, you know, I didn't think it'd be that difficult. But then, you know, looking at the first lesson, I had so many things flying through my head, because, you know, here I am, you know, almost 8 years being involved in the markets, trading a little bit, but just in general, being very privy to all the information. And even hearing you talk for hours on end to people that I don't know, I had picked up a lot of stuff, and I learned a lot of stuff that my friends, you know, really had no experience with. So for me to try to take it back all the way to, you know, what is a market, it was kind of difficult at first. And sitting down and trying to go through a lesson plan like a teacher, I mean, it was something I'd never done before. I mean, I've talked to many people in my life, but it's a little bit different of a setting when you're trying to teach people things, you know, that you're, you know, I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I know more, I'd say, than the average person this about the stock market. My friends, they know nothing about it. I mean, you know, a couple of them play lacrosse, a couple of them play basketball. You know, they're into sports and stuff, and, you know, they're business majors and whatnot. But, you know, the stock market is kind of a foreign concept for a lot of people. So to dial it back, you know, it was really rewarding for me as well, because, you know, I feel like you don't really know something until you're able to teach it. I mean, I can't tell you how many math classes I've been in where the teacher's writing out the stuff on the board and I'm shaking my head, you know, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And come test time, I can't replicate. So it's a completely different ball game teaching somebody something, because that's when you really have to know it. So, you know, not only has it been an awesome experience for me, you know, teaching some of my friends something that I'm pretty passionate about, but I think it's been great for them too, because they've, you know, grown more interested in the material throughout, you know, the first 7 or 8 weeks, and I haven't even really gotten to charts yet. I mean, I've showed them a couple of things, but basically going over basic stuff with them, you know, what is volume, what is a market, what is price discovery, all that little stuff that at first could seem a little nagging, you know, this isn't very interesting, but, you know, I've been surprised, you know, how well it's gone so far.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's very important, because, again, you know, the whole country should be living on a price discovery model. And unfortunately, over the years, and especially the last 8 years, you know, we've kind of gotten away from that. It's more of a directive of how we're supposed to trade. Because, again, you know, even when you, as simple as going to the grocery store, you know, you go to a store and that's a price discovery model, because if their prices are too expensive, you'll go to a cheaper store. So you've made a conscious decision that the price didn't meet your equation. And everything we do comes down to that same price discovery model, because if you're selling a house, okay, and you want to get, let's say, $500,000 in your house, and somebody offers you $4,000, and you end up at $450,000, well, you discovered price at $450,000, and that's where the exchange of wealth for a product takes place, and that's something that many do not understand, and I think that's the biggest problem when we look into markets and we look into how it works, is people don't understand the function of a real market and where you have to go from, and that is the whole key that we have to get back to, and that is, you know, not having a manipulative market right now. Like, for example, our currency, because it's what it's called as a fiat currency, mm-hmm. can be manipulated. When it was backed by gold, I mean, the price of gold could be manipulated, but it's much harder to do. Whereas now, when somebody can basically with a pencil say, hey, we're going to make the dollar worth X, okay, all of a sudden it changes the dynamics, and that is the whole price discovery model. That, you know, it's a place where buyer and seller meet. That's what price discovery is. And that's what I think we all miss out learning the best way to do that. And I think that becomes the problem. And that's the first thing that anybody needs to understand, is we're in what's called an auction market.
Right up near the end of the break, like a true professional, not even looking at the screen. It's Todd Bubba Horwitz's take on markets. We got one more section left, so if you miss a show, you know where to find us, libertytalk.fm. We'll be back after the break with Bubba's final part of the interview. What's up, everybody? This is Xander, the co-host for the day with Todd Bubba Horwitz, my dad. I'm interviewing him. We've gone over a lot of interesting stuff so far. You know, we've covered Bubba's career from the time he was a 17-year-old man. I saw some pictures. You know, he looked like he was 30 back then, so I see why he was such a good salesman. But, Bub, I know a big topic of discussion for you always, and a big topic of teaching is the Federal Reserve. And I know I've got a couple things to share. But, I mean, right now, looking at the economy, you know, rates are on the rise a little bit. You know, what's your take on Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve? I mean, are they going to help us or hurt us from here on out? I know your opinion. I know what they have done so far. But, I mean, is the Fed going to be here, you think, in 20 or 30 years? Or do you think the end of the Fed is coming? I mean, what's your take on it right now?
Well, I think that actually the Fed will probably end eventually. I think that they have not done a very good job, in my opinion, as to what they do. I think that they become too big for their britches. You know, the Fed being a private corporation, but it's owned by the banks. You know, I personally don't understand the logic of how we can have a system that banks can lend out money more than they have in reserve, and eventually basically the banks are creating new money at the same time versus everything else. And so I think that's a problem. Plus the fact that the Fed, although independent and private, it's a private corporation, but they do a lot of work to help the government extend and go over budget. And basically, if you look at the value of our dollars, they have continued to decrease every year since the Fed was brought in. I mean, that is more something that, you know, the central banking system was supposed to be what they call the lender of last resort. Now, I asked the question the other day on the show, and I said, okay, great. If we're going to have a lender of last resort, that's fine, but why should a big institution be too big to fail if the Fed is the lender of last resort? So let the Fed make the debt good to all the depositors for that bank, but let the bank go out of business. Why should we, the taxpayers, have to continue to bail these banks out by creating more dollars? Because every time they create more money or more dollars, all they're doing is issuing a secondary on my capital, and I end up with less money. So I want to know that those are things that bother me. So I really do believe that the Fed will either be totally reorganized at some point, or it will not exist in its current state. Because again, being the lender of last resort versus being somebody who just prints money at will is something that needs to change. Otherwise, we're gonna break ourselves by doing it the way we're doing it right now.
Yeah, you know, I remember it's an interesting concept. I don't remember how old I was, but I remember the topic came up. You know, the U.S. has a ton of debt, and I remember asking, you know, Dad, you know, why can't we just print a bunch of money and call it a day and give that money to whoever we owe it to? And very important lesson in economics, you know. The money in the bills that, you know, circulate the economy are only as valuable as the goods and services that we produce. So when you print more of it, you're essentially not making more money as I used to think, but you're just, you know, making each dollar bill worth a little less because, you know, there's something called, you know, you have a real flow of goods and you have a monetary flow. And, you know, the monetary flow can get as big as it wants, but it's only representative of the real things that go on, you know, goods and services. You sell things at the grocery store. People give haircuts. Every good and service, you know, that is final in the U.S., that's what we're talking about. You talk about what the economy is really worth. So when the Fed prints more money, like you said, you're exactly right, they're devaluing each single dollar bill in your pocket. And another great point I've heard you stress many times, and I actually, you know, I'm an econ major at school, and we had to give our final presentations on our research project a couple weeks ago, and I chose my topic to be about the Fed, and my main research question was, you know, has the Fed fundamentally changed basically in the past 15 years? And the point I was trying to get at, you know, it was, has the Fed fundamentally changed? But moreover than the statistical tests I had to run for, you know, my teacher to make him happy, you know, I was looking at, you know, what has the Fed done a little differently and what, you know, maybe shouldn't they have done over this 15-year span that I had been covering, that they could have done differently. And I think it's a lot of interesting figures. You know, I don't have my sheet in front of me, but, you know, you look at the Fed's portfolio back in 2001, and this was, you know, a couple months before the dot-com bubble, you know, he had a huge recession. I mean, not as big as the one in 2009, 2008. But, you know, U.S. Treasury securities, which are bills, notes, and bonds, made up 85% of the Fed's portfolio. So that means, you know, the other 15% cash, gold, little stuff like that. And you look back, I studied five time periods, you know, basically looking at business cycles in the economy. You know, you have peaks and troughs. You know, peaks are when the economy is operating at its best. Troughs are when, you know, we're at the bottom. So a recession, you know, technically would be a trough. And the fourth time period in my study was, I believe it was June of 2009. That was when we were at our lowest point GDP growth-wise during the Great Recession. And the makeup of the Fed's portfolio then was only 29%. Of bills, notes, and bonds. Now, I'm not a genius, but I didn't really need a statistical test to tell me that the Fed had fundamentally changed. And I think, you know, a very eye-opening number that still is on the Fed's balance sheet today is mortgage-backed securities. If you take a look at the Fed's portfolio today, $1.7 trillion out of their $4.1 trillion worth of assets is mortgage-backed securities. I mean, the Fed, in relation to U.S. GDP, if you take a look back at 2001, the Fed's portfolio made up about 5% of the U.S. GDP. Now it makes up about 25%. So again, you know what? I ran these tests knowing what I would find, but I mean, the Fed has changed a lot. They've gotten a lot bigger. They've done a lot of things, like you said, that they probably shouldn't have done. I think, you know, there's basically two types of economics, you know, the Keynesian or the version and the Austrian version. One of them focuses on a lot more government intervention, and the other one kind of says let markets work. And I think you would agree with me that we've been far too focused on the government intervention side of economics instead of letting markets work the way that they're supposed to. Because, you know, supply and demand can only find each other when you let them. I mean, you know, basic principles of economics: you set price floors, price ceilings. You make people do things that aren't in the best interests of what they would do otherwise. Then that's where you see a market start to not work as well as it usually would. So, you know, I gave a presentation. My presentation was a lot better than my paper because I feel like I'm a lot better speaking to people about it than writing about it. But it was super interesting. And even to the point that you look at your dollar bill today, and you've definitely heard this before because I know I've heard it a couple hundred times, but it, instead of saying silver certificate, it now says Federal Reserve note. So, you know, this is not going to happen, but were the economy to collapse tomorrow, you know, the bills in your pocket would be, you know, worth no more than the ink in the paper that they're printed on. And that's, you know, a key thing I think that people have to realize is that, you know, these dollar bills are all liabilities of the Fed. And the bigger and basically more preposterous they get their policies, the worse it is, I think, for everybody in general. I mean, even if you look at quantitative easing, we had three rounds, 2008, 2010, and 2012. And for me, I mean, a big part of my project was looking at, you know, it didn't work in 2008, and that's why they did it again in 2010. And it didn't work in 2010, so they did it again in 2012. So, you know, my big focus and my overarching thing, you know, was, you know, maybe the Fed needs to take a step back. And then I think they needed to take a step back during the Great Recession. Like, you know, like you said, they kind of stepped in a little too much and didn't let some banks fail that, you know, probably didn't belong here anyways. I mean, that's the great thing about markets. They work for you if you let them. You know, if you don't, they don't work. But we got about 30 seconds left. Any closing notes you want to lead the people with today before you get back at the helm tomorrow?
No, I think that, again, you did a great job representing what we think about and what we think. And I think that, again, you just have to let the markets work. And the only real market is a free market. And that's what we have to get back to is true, free, honest markets that are built with price discovery.
You heard it here first, the man, the myth, the legend, Todd Bubba Horwitz. It was great, great interviewing him today. You know, the guy's got so much to say every day, and he's got a lot of knowledge, but I don't know if a lot of you knew about, you know, what he'd done in his past life, you know, 30 years ago, I think, today. But, you know, it was great being on the show today, and if you miss a show, you know where to find us, libertytalk.fm. And if you listen to the station, I'll be back Saturday with the Sporting Edge. We'll see you all tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.